a street corner in Pest. Friends tell me that I'm a master raconteur. At least I think that's what they're telling me. Perhaps it's an anagram. No matter, I must recount the following. Every tall tale should have its own walking tour. Would you like to follow your humble author around Lille? What? You'd rather dress as George Sewell and meander Gateshead's municipal car parks, hearing about Jack Carter and Hard Knocks up the north? Oh, be careful what you joke about. In fact, it takes a very brave man to joke about anything these days. In the strange times that we live in, there's nothing funny about humour. For a walking tour, there is. In your unread comments, I noticed the following. Where were your accommodations in Budapest? A reference to my other humble works, episode 7, Socks, Shoes and the Orient Express. Happy to oblige, I sent a message back, 44 to 46. The proviso being that the street name will have changed. One assumes, 35 years later, not much will be named after Lenin in contemporary Middle Europe. I also mentioned that, back in the day, one side of the ground floor was a second-hand wedding dress rental service. Look out for it. You never know. It's surprising what survives. I thought nothing more of it. But the next thing I know, a photo has arrived, captioned, "Do you recognise this?" Yes, the first walking tour that I know of has just taken its first photo of the first punter outside a postcard from Lille location, the entrance to Erzsebet Kurort, 4446. Am I due a commission? I know I shouldn't have, and I know you won't believe me, but, dear reader, I went a bit dewy-eyed. Closer inspection showed that the dress hire outlet may have survived, there being a big black-and-white Soviet-style wedding photo in the gap above the doors. It's surprising what's lasted and what hasn't. Communism? Nope. Roman Empire? Nope. European Union? Borderline. Wedding dresses? Of course. The Tooth Fairy? You bet. Santa? Indestructible. Expressing my gratitude, I cheekily asked, can you get inside? Citing as a must-see, the first thing that came into my head, the old Habsburg solid iron lift that never worked. Wary that I might have sent a good chap to the wrong place, I felt obliged to the attic to address my daring do-box and unearth my old Ibbots registration. Sure enough, my residency was marked out as such in the local back-to-front style. BP, Budapest, VII, District 7, Lenin Kurort, Kurort means Boulevard, 44 to 46, V, crossed out and corrected to III 23. To distinguish between the different parts of an address, the Hungarians use a mixture of Roman and modern numerals. If I'd been on the II floor instead of the III, then I might have had an even better tale to tell. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Something jumps out from that form and slaps one about the face. Can you see what it is? No, you're in good company. I missed it for nearly four decades. As you know, Fise te vende Galazzo Neve means Name de Gasterbe, which is a bit easier to translate. Within the box to the right of that text, and above Lenin Kurort, is the name of that host family. And I'm not joking. It really does look like, in the backward style and local spelling, the George Soroses. Google calls. Lenin Kurort was originally named Erzsebet Kurort, with block 44 to 46 being completed in 1889, in accordance to the plans of Siegmund Quintner, whose client was the lawyer Caroline Baumgarten. The Baumgarten's family wealth derived from crop trading, which allowed for several rental palaces to be built. Including the attic rooms, it was five stories high, the lower floor and inner courtyard being retail outlets. The lower inner courtyard was a cafe, the three balcony floors above led to palatial apartments. Externally, by local standards, Quintner's design was rather plain and would have appeared little more than a grey tenement had it not been for the pitched embellishments about the attic windows and a spire added to the top of the street corner at Dub Utka. What kind of Budapest did 44-46 emerge into? I'm indebted to Robert A. N. Harvey, who provides us with this contemporary account from the Morning Review. Budapest is a very beautiful city and only second to Vienna. Its grain trade is immense. It's connected by a suspension bridge 150 foot high and 13 foot high long, connecting Budapest. Budapest has superb buildings. Its hotels rival those of any city in the world. Its academy has 800 paintings, 50,000 engravings and 12,000 drawings. The railway stations are marvels of costliness, surpassing anything in America. The Jews here have the finest synagogue on the continent. The Greeks have a beautiful church. There is a large building, gorgeously decorated, built by the municipality solely for balls and private parties. There is a magnificent theatre, built and supported by the government. All the royal palaces and government buildings in Austro-Hungary are painted in bright yellow. Having enthused about Budapest, he is less keen about the countryside. An Hungarian peasant village is far from beautiful. The absence of trees and the presence of dirt and mud are its striking peculiarities. If the peasants are farmers, their houses are clustered together, while the farmlands they till stretch away for miles in every direction. The interiors of the peasant homes are not unattractive. The floors are of stamped earth, as wood is scarce. The peasants are content to obey the master of the manor and the village priests. And somewhat lukewarm about the gypsies. In the gypsy villages, they herd together like animals. There is no marrying or giving in marriage. Both sexes go nude until 14. They have no written language. They mostly live by plunder, though they profess to be horse traders. Harvey outlines a Hungary where there is a great difference between Budapest and a countryside which is Austro-Hungary's grain basket, owned by absent landlords. Hungary is a place of many different peoples, distinguishable and segregated by culture, language and genes. 5% of the entire population are Jews, 18% of the university students are Jews, and 2/3 of these study jurisprudence. Jew and Gentile have little love for each other. Marriage between them is not permitted. That Jewish population wasn't evenly distributed. In the 1900 census, the population of Budapest was 703,000, 23% of whom were Jews. In Erzsébet-Kerület District 7, the proportion was 36%, the highest of any district. The Jews also tended to be better off than other Hungarians and were notably well represented amongst the professions and landowners. Likewise, in their living conditions, 75% of Jews lived in dwellings which consisted of more than one room, as opposed to 37% of Christians. As such, 44-46 was high-class accommodation built by Jewish businessmen on the easternmost side of Pest's Jewish quarter. Upon completion, one entire floor was occupied by Mór Jókai, a prolific writer, chronicler of the Hungarian Revolution of 1848, the Hungarian Charles Dickens. He lived there with his second wife, 20-year-old actress Nagy Bella, scandalously 50 years his junior, the old goat. Shall we steal a phrase from the local Finno Ulrik? Sesex bolondot, sex fool? Speaking of 20-year-old Hungarian girls, your humble author's landlady could hear tiptoeing size 4 feet in her sleep. She could also, from behind closed and bolted doors, see a little silver crucifix bouncing between cleavage in the moonlight. She would emerge from her room, limping at great speed, striking her walking stick to the girl's backside with impressive accuracy. The kind of thing a Soros might do. This was, fortunately, all the fault of the filthy local girls. Old Granny Soros not only mothered me, but recommended a lonely niece, marooned loveless in a Romanian enclave in the provinces, who, ominously, was being sent for. Dear God. Razor-sharp regular readers with instant recall, an IQ of over 200, a photographic memory and a suspicious mind, might tell you that Sonia the cam girl's auntie might be exactly the right age. I cannot possibly comment. Returning to the last years of the 19th century, Jókai and his wife occupied part of the second floor of the residence, with other members of his extended family occupying the rest. My Hungarian isn't great. Also, Hungarian women change their name upon marriage, but not necessarily to their husbands. Then they use their maiden name, husband's name, and married name interchangeably, often back to front. A situation not helped by nearly all of them being called Bella with one L, and those that aren't being called Bella with two L's. From this position of disadvantage, as far as I can work out, my research indicates that the inhabitants of those palatial second-floor apartments fought like cats in a sack. Jókai would winter in the south of France and return to Pest in the spring. In 1904, upon his return, he was taken ill with influenza that developed into a pneumonia which took his life, aged 80, on December the 19th of that year. The building's owner, by then coffeehouse magnate Mr. Leo Berger, named the building after him. No, not Sex Fool Towers, but Jockey Udvar. A plaque was installed on the outside ground floor of the Dob Utker Street corner. A sign to that effect, which remains to this day, was erected above the fourth floor, facing Erzbetkarut. Udvar may be translated as house or court, but I prefer courtyard, as if country ground enclosed by farm buildings, or in this case a covered courtyard surrounded by apartments. In order to up the family feud to max, Jockey left all of the rights to all of his works to his young wife Bella. As ever, the simple young actress knew the soul of the rich old man better than anyone else hoping to inherit. From 1910, the ground floor of what we may now call Jockey Udvar included the Circle Café. Operated by Joseph Weisberger, it was frequented mainly by writers and teachers. A note on coffee life. Sigmund Morridge describes another coffee house, the Orkese House, at the other end of District 7, thus. Who were the people who frequented that place? Furriers and textile merchants. You should know that millions changed hands there. Practically speaking, this is where the stock exchange was. That was the heyday of the café, when every day there were 50 carriages parked in the courtyard. That's when the merchandise found its way here. This is where the city's commercial arteries beat, among three courtyards. One of the merchants will have been Moore Schucks, a partner of Marcus and Schucks, a fabric shop on Petőfi Street, the most fashionable street in the then booming Budapest. The Zuxis had a daughter called Erzsébet. To prevent endless Bella and Bella-type confusion between Erzsébet and Erzsébetkarut, we shall call her Miss Zucks. She was married to a Tivadar Schwartz. She was to marry a Tivadar Schwartz, a boarding school and university graduate from the provinces, studying law in Budapest. As per Moritz's description, cafes were places of intense discourse. Shall we picture the teachers and writers at 4446's Circle Café as intellectuals whispering summarised Proust in a chess farm? Or as a place of intellectual debate and political agitation during a time of great upheaval across Middle Europe and revolutionary Russia? The National Association of Teachers was founded at Jockey Udvar in 1918. This was not as a modern trade union, rather as a vanguard for radical change. By now, the Central Powers, which included Austro-Hungary, had lost the First World War. The boulevards throbbed with an influx of disgruntled soldiers, many of them radicalised as prisoners of war in Bolshevik Russia. Trouble brewed in the streets. A left-wing government, which included many Jews, turned into a Red Terror. A counter-coup overthrew the Reds and replaced them with a White Terror, some of which was aimed at Jews. The patrons of the Circle Café and the residents of the apartments above will not have been immune. Austro-Hungary had ceased to exist. The new Kingdom of Hungary did badly out of the Treaty of Trianon, 1920, losing most of its territory to the hated Romanians and the newly formed countries of Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia. We must now picture Budapest, including Jockey Udvar, packed with ethnically cleansed Hungarians who had fled from lost territories. The Barclay Daily Gazette of December the 27th, 1922, offers the following eyewitness account from its alumni, Russell White Bell, of the American Relief Agency. He told of the misery of men, women and children of the Hungarian middle class, and of hall bedrooms, which he had himself seen occupied by four or five persons, describing housing conditions so congested that 4,000 families, by actual survey, lived last winter in unheated boxcars in Budapest. Many of the city directories from the 1920s have survived and show the inhabitants of 44-46 to be largely professional people and business owners, many of them Jewish. The Circle Café is an athletics and swimming club. Jakob Hegelius is a doctor, as are Zygmunt Zekely and Desko Ungar. István Bohár and Erno Tepper are lawyers. Odone Weiss is in business. Somogyi Moore advertises his music school. The building is now owned by Gisela and Dora Perlmutter. A few blocks away, the artist Isaac Perlmutter's palatial family home is at Andrézy Kurut 60. Nearby, Miss Zucks and Travador Schwartz married in 1924. As well as learning a legal practice, Tivador also took responsibility for his wife's financial interests, which included properties in Budapest, Vienna and Berlin, as well as the family's fabric store. In 1926, the now Mrs. Schwartz gave birth to a son, Paul, and in August 1930 to a second son, Georgie. As Budapest's fortunes improved, so did the Schwartzes. They moved to a desirable area, a large apartment opposite the Hungarian Parliament building in Kossuth Tér. They acquired a summer house on Lupa, one of the Danube Islands, which was designed by and shared with Georgi Farkas and family, the architect husband of Mrs. Schwartz's sister Clara. Winter holidays were taken in Austria. Paul Soros was to become an Olympic swimmer. Budapest continued to boom, not least because of its close political and economic ties to Austria and Germany, countries that were now beginning to pass anti-Jewish laws. In 1936, aware of the sensitivity surrounding their travels to Austria and business interests in Germany, the family changed their names, and six-year-old Schwartz Georgi became George Soros. As Europe marched towards war, so did Hungary. Two Jewish laws were passed there in May 1938. In February 1939, Hungary joined the Axis, in return for which they were ceded some territories lost at Trianon. Life during the first years of the Second World War proved to be little different than before. All changed in March 1943, when the Hungarian army, along with their German allies, were defeated at Stalingrad. 80,000 Hungarians were killed or missing, and 63,000 wounded. On the 19th of March 1944, Germany invaded their by now faltering ally. Within days, Adolf Eichmann had arrived, tasked with making Hungary Jew-free. During May and June 1944, 437,000 Jews were transported, nearly all from the countryside rather than from Budapest. Ominously, in the 1944 home data sheets, the number of residents and landlords obliged to wear the yellow star must be listed. Properties are categorised as being Jewish or non-Jewish. From the 21st of June 1944, Budapest Jews were concentrated into Jew houses, or yellow star houses, named after the yellow stars of David pinned onto the properties. According to yellowstarhouses.org, 4446 wasn't a yellow star house, but the neighbouring properties at Dobudka 60 and Dobudka 65 were, as were Erzsébetkő at 41 opposite and Erzsébetkő at 50 and 38 nearby. A large proportion of the yellow star houses were in or near the existing Jewish Pest ghetto, which included 4446, but many others were scattered around Budapest, perhaps to dissuade the Allies from bombing the city. We must now imagine the wealthy professional Jewish families of 44-46 cleared to Yellow Star houses or concentrated at Eichmann's ghetto, which was still within District 7 but closer to the Danube. Clearing would have meant the sequestration of their possessions and apartments, which would fill with refugees fleeing the advancing Soviet army. Such clearings were aided by a young George Soros, now living as if a Christian. Jokai's wife, Bella Nagy, also known as Jokai Nagyabeli and Grotzabeli, had left at the outbreak of war and gone to live in London, where she died in 1947, aged 67. George Soros's uncle, George Farkas, and his wife Clara were to leave in 1945. The Perlmutter's palatial residence at Andrássy Kerület 60 had become the headquarters of the Hungarian version of the Nazi Party, the Arrow Cross. The photo above, dated October 1944, shows arrested Jewish women being marched past Fenszetlenczi Street. This intersects Erzsébet Kerület at block 30 to 42. There were marches in the other direction too, towards the international ghetto on the Pest side, opposite Margaret Island, where Jews who had protected passports were concentrated. This is at the northwestern end of Erzsébet Kerület, by which point it is named Szentestván. Also marching, columns making their way to the railway stations for the controversial Gold for Blood trains. The Soviet offensive against Budapest began on 29th of October 1944. In December, Eichmann's ghetto was walled in and many more Jews were concentrated within it. At its closest point, this ghetto was about 100 yards to the west of 44-46 in the direction of the Danube. By the 26th of December, Budapest was encircled by the Soviets and under heavy bombardment. Residents were starving and jammed into bomb-damaged buildings. During my stay in the 1980s, the existence of internal pre-war ornamentation suggested that 44-46 wasn't badly damaged at this time. Judging from the old photos, Buda took more damage, it being much hillier than Pest, and the obvious place to mount a stout defence. The siege ended on the 13th of February 1945 in unconditional surrender. By this time, 32,000 buildings had been destroyed, with destruction or damage to 27% of the city. 38,000 civilians had died through starvation or military action. Budapest's privations hadn't ended. The starvation continued. There was no wood for heating or cooking. Hundreds of thousands of Hungarians were deported to Soviet labour camps. Elections in 1945 returned a multi-party parliamentary, a multi-party parliament, with the communists only getting 17% of the vote. Strong arm tactics resulted in the Hungarian Workers' People's Party standing unopposed in the 1949 elections, after which the People's Republic of Hungary was declared. Between those two elections, on the 13th of May 1948, George Soros's brother, still known as Pál, defects to Austria. His application for displaced person status while residing in Salzburg leaves a paper trail. On the digital version, his birthday is incorrect, to throw us off the scent. But on the actual card, his details match. He notes his relatives as being his parents, who are still resident in Budapest. He omits to mention his brother George, and lists his only other relative as his uncle George Farkas, now resident in Miami. Pál Soros's previous occupations are listed on his application. I would love to translate his wartime experience as if from under, say, Kriegsmarine, as if a U-boat commander torpedoing fleeing orphans. But I'm afraid I must be honest and translate it as the sort of looks a bit similar to that in German, without work because of wartime. Also listed are his ski trips to Austria, including as an Olympic skier. On the 2nd of March 1949, his application is stamped ineligible, by which time he had already emigrated to the United States. George Soros had previously left for the United Kingdom in 1947, joining his brother and uncle in the United States in 1956. Also in 1956, conditions in Hungary and discontent with the communist regime reach boiling point, and in October of that year, an uprising begins. One of the bones of contention was the allocation of housing to Communist Party Lickspittles, who presumably occupied a cramped and austere 44-46 on a boulevard now renamed Leninkurut. Or, as between the wars, may we use our imaginations to assume that the very writers and journalists that helped to spark the uprising were agitating in the café, perhaps as one of the uprising's organising forums. One of the first events of the uprising was a protest march, which is pictured at the junction of Lenin and Kiraly, the street corner in the other direction, next to Dob. Here, Leninkurut 44-46 shows sign of uprising damage, especially to the upper stories, perhaps because of sniper activity. Soon after, the uprising was put down by a Soviet invasion, and by the 10th of November 1956, Budapest had been pacified. Hungarian casualties totaled around 2,500 dead, with an additional 20,000 wounded. Budapest bore the brunt of the bloodshed, with over 1,500 civilians killed. A woman sells flowers on a battle-damaged corner of Leninkurut 44-46 in a now-pacified Budapest in January 1957. The plaque commemorating Jokai remains to the left-hand side on Dobrudka. In the immediate aftermath, many thousands of Hungarians were arrested. Eventually, 26,000 of these were brought before the Hungarian courts. 22,000 were sentenced and imprisoned, 13,000 interned, and 229 executed. Approximately 200,000 fled Hungary as refugees. Two of those refugees were Theodor and Erzsébet Soros, who joined their sons and in-laws in the United States. At this point, dear reader, following the extensive research outlined above, there being only four Soroses, and all of them living in America since 1957, I'm forced to concede that it is probably most unlikely that I was sleeping in George Soros's spare room in the 1980s. I think we all suspected that anyway. Apologies to his grandmother. The Soviet version of events conceded that the Hungarian government had made mistakes, but the discontent had been hijacked by fascists, Hitlerites, hooligans, and the West. A new Hungarian government was formed, with Soviet approval, over Janos Kádár, who was General Secretary of the Hungarian Socialist Workers' Party for the next 32 years, until the tail end of the Cold War in 1988. During this time, Hungary became the happiest hut in the Warsaw Pact barracks. Not a high bar, given the state of places like Albania, Ceausescu's Romania, and General Jaruzelski's Poland. Now, dear reader, I hear you ask, what was 44-46 like in the 1980s? It and my landlady were as described in episode 7 of Postcard from Lille. May I add the following from my contemporary journal? Mrs. Magyaros is a stalwart of the abut system. They need her spare room, she needs the money. Her apartment is central on Leningrad. As well as her percentage, she commands sufficient commission for 2 bottles of good quality wine a week from washing, ironing and cooking meals, payable in hard currency rather than the forint she receives from the tourist ministry. Her son lives there too. He's very tall and finds himself extremely important in his Polish leather jacket and worker's strides. He is monosyllabic and has an impossibly large moustache. She has a daughter too, somewhere. Mrs. Magyaros has rules. They are set in concrete. There is to be no bringing of dead pigeons onto the premises, as the North Vietnamese do, or making fires from twigs and leaves on the floor of your room, as the Moldovans. Guests can use their own room as they wish, unaccompanied obviously, and can use the toilet and bathroom for a maximum of 15 minutes. If a lukewarm bath is required, a bath club can be hired. Rates vary for a maximum of 20 minutes. Guests have to be in by 10 p.m, as that's when the porter locks the doors to the street, but not before 5 p.m, as guests would be best occupied walking the streets before then. Guests might occasionally be invited into the front room at Mrs. Magyaros's discretion. The final and most important rule was that house rules applied and were likely to vary at any time. If you are polite, well-dressed and good-mannered, Mrs. Magyaros will insist that you are German. You must call her Fraulein. She will address you in a pidgin Germano-Finno-Uric, which is easy to understand. Fraulein is quite small and wears thick glasses which do nothing for her looks and little for her eyesight, as she carries a large broken magnifying glass with her at all times. On our first meeting she showed me the bathroom with its huge wooden toilet and my own small room partitioned from the corridor next to the front door. Contained a bed, high ceiling, large wardrobe, round table, mirror, 3 paintings, 2 rustic, 1 cosmopolitan, 2 lights and a chair. It was carpeted partway up the walls and, most importantly to a landlord, would contain my rent-paying self. Opening the curtain of my high, narrow sash window showed a view across the balcony and down to the courtyard. To lock the front door, the key went 2 times clockwise, was returned to the vertical and then withdrawn. Was unlocked by 2 anti-clockwise turns and then a gentle pressure upon the frame during a 3rd half turn. As a German, even if you lock yourself out, she will rise to let you in, unlike the Poles who are left asleep on the step, and the Albanians not only left there but forced to scrub it the next day. Do not kiss your door key while walking past comrade neighbour Yvonne Ivana's wayward daughter's window, she who sits all day dressed only in a towel. Frau Lorn Magyaros will notice, even from behind the closed and shuttered windows of a pitch-black 9:59 p.m. Pest Street corner. A contemporary account goes on to mention days without water, heating or food. Shops are empty, conscripts are emaciated, men without boots, their trousers held up with string. Buildings are cheaply and shoddily made. Newer apartments are cramped, damp and drafty. There's a shortage of paint, wood, metal, light bulbs and paper. Away from Budapest, the countryside remains similar to Harvey's description from the late 1890s. Roads were of compacted mud, ploughing was by hand. Boats, fords and chain ferries made up for a lack of bridges. I receive another message. I've got in now, but I can't get out. Shall we Photoshop our trapped walking tour punter's modern-day photos into a postcard from Jockey Udvar, I think we should. In the modern day, there's an H Dentist Dentist's on the bottom floor. The Habsburg lift has been enclosed. The place has had a lick of paint and is properly illuminated, showing some of the original ornamentation. Part of the top floor is a hostel, which, via TripAdvisor, looks suitably IKEA sparse, and has been even further partitioned, making it look more cramped than 40 years ago. However, there seems to be double glazing, and no doubt there is Wi-Fi. Some of the apartments seem to be private residences, with air conditioning, a little table set for breakfast on the balconies, which is rather cute. The courtyard itself seems to be private, with separate key access for residents. Outside, there is still a row of retail outlets on the ground floor, all of them occupied. At the left hand, Dobut side, there are Hamdi stores, branded as confectionery and ice cream. Hamdi claim to have been there continually for over 100 years, but their outlets can't be seen in the older photos. Andrassy 60 Karut is now the Terra Museum. George Soros is a billionaire investor and philanthropist. I'm sitting here reading this and worrying about Punter. The chap seemed so keen that I gave him a few more places to visit. Some were genuine, some I just made up. Judging by the flora and the orientation and colour of the moss in his last photo, I would suggest that he's in a tent in the woods near Bratislava. Are there still bears and wolves? Hope he's okay. Vijay.